Good morning. Paul's talk brought back some bad memories. You know, I was so impressed that I even dusted off my schoolboy Greek, ho tu holu holos, the whole of wholeness. Such a revolting expression. Now, at one level, it's quite simple. Innovate or die. But we all recognize that, in fact, it's not as simple as that. Attempts at innovation, no matter how laudable, can be misguided and can fail. Perhaps the failures will be disastrous. And in any case, there's always the question of opportunity costs. There's a need to set priorities, even for attempts at innovation, if you are to get the most benefit from the use of resources. Innovation in defence needs some special attributes. As I once commented to what was then known as the Industry Commission, known to its friends, I understand, the Flat Earth Society, defence does strongly believe in competition. The ultimate competition of armed conflict between nations. This blinding statement of the obvious did not make it into the Industry Commission's final report, but I would like to think that it caused a few moments' reflection. For the special marketplace of defence, namely the battlefield, can be unforgiving, both for the direct participants and for the nation on whose behalf they are fighting. It's important, then, to be confident that innovation in defence is moving in the right direction and that the risks be understood and ironed out well before the ultimate test of military operations. In this talk, I shall touch on the context provided by Defence's record of innovation in Australia, and then bring out some of the more important points from my chapter on technology and innovation in the publication. Let's start with the Australian Defence Force itself. It seems to me that one of the enduring, and indeed endearing, characteristics of the ADF is its predisposition to be innovative and resourceful. This is a great attribute. There is a culture and an expectation that members of the Defence Force, no matter how junior, will take the initiative. And this is an important point of differentiation from the cultures that prevail in some other Defence Forces, and it positions our Defence Force well to take advantage of the new opportunities in command and control, for example, that modern technology is offering. It must be said, however, that not all of this culture of innovation transfers itself to Canberra. There are times when the culture in Canberra, both military and civilian, can be solid, even timorous or fearful, rather than imaginative and forward-looking. So the record in this respect is more mixed. Nevertheless, if we take a few steps back from the coalface and get things in perspective, we can recognise the magnitude of the change, the innovation that has taken place over the years in the major areas being addressed at this launch today. It is important to acknowledge the corporatisation and the privatisation of the dockyards and factories formerly owned by the government. There were the important steps that led to the greater use of the private sector in support areas following government consideration of Alan Wrigley's report on defence in the community in 1990 and of the Defence Efficiency Review that Malcolm McIntosh chaired in 1997. More recently, there has been the review by Malcolm Kinnaird that led to the new arrangement for the DMO. And it would be appropriate also to mention the changes to high-level command arrangements instigated in particular by John Baker, and he was Chief of the Defence Force. There has indeed also been some progress in the area of defence policy for industry, not least, Paul, through the contributions that you have made since your return to the ANU in the early 1990s. But Paul's work well illustrates some of the problems that can be faced in this area. I recall all too clearly the criticism that Paul was subjected to by those who really should have known better for his innovative work in the early 1990s on priority setting in defence industry policy. Yet when the hue and cry was over, these same people were quick to adopt his ideas as their own. So the good news is that change and innovation do occur, sometimes at quite a profound level, and in spite of the conservative cultures that can characterise the defence force and defence more generally. Just think how different defence is today from what it was, say, 20 years ago. The not so good news is that a lot of this change has come and has had to come from the outside, through ministerial initiative in particular. And a lot of the change has caused much resentment and angry incomprehension at the time of initiation and implementation. And overall, the rate of progress has often been slow. I have two reasons for saying all of this. First, it would be simply quite remarkable if there were not further scope for innovation in the relationships between defence and industry or with the community more generally, even though it might not yet be clear, what these new possibilities might be. On balance, defence has shown an ability to reform, especially when spurred on by ministerial edict. So we can have a good level of confidence that if industry has some well thought through innovative ideas that will bring benefit to defence, sooner or later they will be listened to. I stress, of course, that the ideas do have to be good ones and that they do have to bring benefit to defence and not just to the industry concerned. Second, my observations on innovation in defence provide the context for the more specific matter of scientific or science-based innovation, which is the subject of my paper, to which I now turn. The principal conclusion of my paper is that, in many ways, scientific innovation in defence in Australia is in good shape. And let me just add that when I accepted the invitation to write this paper, I obviously had a few hobby horses in the stable that I could spur into action around the paddock, but I had not expected to draw that particular conclusion. But the more I wrote, the more I talked, the more I thought, the more I was drawn towards what I think is quite a key observation. Scientific innovation is in good shape. Now, I won't read my paper as such to you. I will pick out some particular features or issues, and I've got 5 points to make to you. First, the importance of professional scientific advice to support our national defence and security effort is well established. Next year, we'll see 100 years since the earliest antecedent of today's position of Chief Defence Scientist. And a similar position had been established some 10 years earlier, would you believe, in the colony of Victoria. So long ago, in fact, that Queen Victoria was still Queen and Empress. So all you Victorians should be proud. Despite some ups and downs over the years, the STO today is in good shape and has an expanded national role in leading the application of science to counter-terrorism. Further, there is a wealth of world-class understanding and experience in science and technology and in how to apply this to Australia's national defence and security interests. This is especially in DSTO, but also in some cases in industry and in other national research organisations. My second point is that it's not that difficult to derive a set of sensible and practical criteria to help with the task of setting priorities and choosing what gets funded and what does not get funded. We are fortunate in Australia in that we are not in the strategic front line, at least in classical military terms. This means that we can usually afford to wait for others to take the lead in applying new technology to defence, and then, often using our highly privileged relationships with countries such as the US and the UK, buy it from them. But there are still gaps that need attending to, sometimes in subtle, very subtle ways. And sometimes opportunities arise that are simply far too good to overlook. All of this can lead to the need to conduct scientific investigations and to develop our own Australian products. And to my mind, there are four broad criteria that apply along the following lines. Where Australia has critical needs that are so different from those of other nations that their products don't come sufficiently close to what we require. Second, where we have sensitive and compelling national security concerns. Third, where not even our closest allies are prepared to share sensitive information or material with us. And fourthly, where a new idea has emerged with potential benefits so compelling that it would be folly not to take it further. These criteria, either separately or in combination, are a guide to the more detailed questions to ask, a conceptual framework, rather than a catechism with direct answers. And further, it is not unknown for allies to become much more open with us once they realise that we are doing our work in fields that they regard as sensitive. Let me make that a little bit more concrete for you by offering you some examples. Our different needs were behind the development of the Jindalee over-the-horizon radar. Our different terrain and vegetation require uniquely Australian camouflage patterns. And Australia's different military character requires a customised approach to at least some aspects of command support systems. Research in cryptography and counter-terrorism are just two areas where national sensitivities can apply. Reluctance of allies to share with us, even with us, has led to Australian innovation in radar cross-section reduction and, better known perhaps, in the acoustic tiles for the Collins-class submarines. There's a theme here, it's called signature management. And another theme that one often comes across is the weaknesses as well as the strengths of key weapons and sensors. and the Nokia decoy, and the Starlight computer security device, and the Shapes Vector computer system security device, have just been three of the innovative ideas that were just too good to ignore. And of course, there are many more examples. Thirdly, I should mention the Capability and Technology Demonstrator Program, CTDs. Defence has been running this since 1997-98 with its focus on how to exploit fast-moving high technologies. This remains a challenge. How does a slow, ponderous organisation exploit new technologies that are moving at a speed that is absolutely without precedent? The CTD initiative has proved a valuable source of additional funding for innovation and an invaluable catalyst for cultural change. My fourth point is, what about the future? A lot of defence effort, if I can voice a prejudice, goes at best into solving today's problems, often trying to solve yesterday's problems, rather than trying to think what tomorrow's problems might be. Soothsaying is an ever-prone activity that attracts ridicule. So what? At least we have to make an attempt to look into the future and to anticipate the changes and the opportunities. Here are my four attempts at chancing my arm. First, new science and technology will continue to bring changes. The opportunities will, in effect, seem limitless. Technology and war fighting will continue to go hand in hand. It ought to be redundant to say all of this, but in my experience, the record of its being recognised in practice is not always encouraging. Second, will there be changes in security policy, in strategic policy that is, and will they affect priorities for innovation? To my mind, both to no questions, at least at the level of policy principle. So we will continue to need to apply innovative science to our own special needs and to fill the gaps left or caused by others. Will there in the future be adequate levels of choice? This is more speculative, but with continued consolidation of defence industries around the globe, choice, as Paul has observed, is reducing. And it might become the case that, at least in a few critical areas, Australia should consider taking part in joint projects led by overseas partners to ensure that our real high priority needs are being met. As these days I am a scholar, I will add a footnote. In 2003, not that long ago, so this data is probably more or less up to date, the United States defence R&D budget was five times that of the EU nations combined. And furthermore, without the combination, without the challenge integration across national boundaries that the EU has, five times. So there are implications here for where we will need to source the really high-tech stuff from a few years from now. My fourth point is that, to my mind, and for a variety of reasons, the trend towards in-service upgrades will, if anything, increase. This will provide significant opportunity for innovation, either independently in Australia or, and probably for preference, in collaboration with the company or country of origin. And my fifth and final point of the five take-out points relating to innovation and science is this one. How can we make a good system better? I'm a great believer in firm foundations, so removing any ambiguities in the government's defence and security policies would be valuable, as would ensuring a high level of consistency between strategic ambition, funding levels, and resource allocation within the defence budget. The fact that I'm mentioning this, of course, connotes my belief that there are some inconsistencies. And there are some matters that need attention in the management of the CTD programme, such as how those CTD projects that prove successful get taken further. Shock, horror, some of the CTD projects actually work. But the biggest steps to help improve defence innovation would come from further cultural change. This would involve greater recognition of the importance of science in our national psyche. If only we could enthuse about science to a fraction of the level that we enthuse about sport. Less reluctance in some parts of industry to seize the opportunities for innovation. And finally, less reluctance in parts of defence to accept the benefits of Australian innovation that are already there. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you.